Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Secular Faith. The author is Mark Smith, who is a professor of political science at the University of Washington. I hope that you enjoy this interview that I did with Mark. Welcome back to the New Political Science podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and today I have the real pleasure to talk with Mark Smith, who is the author of Secular Faith, How Culture Has Trumped Religion in American Politics. Mark, how are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah, Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on. You have this new book with a very powerful cover. I would like you both to maybe just tell us, those that are listening, about the cover. But before you do that, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Washington in Seattle, where I've been for the last 18 years. I'm also an adjunct professor in the comparative religion program here and also the Department of Communication. So my work really crosses over between political science and sociology and comparative religion, and in the past has included a lot of elements of communication, and so I'm comfortable in any of those spots.
So tell us about this cover. In doing this podcast, I have become very interested in the quality and how compelling some covers are, and your cover book covers, it meets that. So maybe you could just tell us about this image, how you chose it, and sort of how it sets up the start of the book.
Sure. I actually turned over the cover design entirely to the University of Chicago Press. They of course gave me a chance to recommend something, but I said, look, this is outside of my area of expertise. I'll trust you all, your production and marketing people, to find a good one. And they in fact did. So it's kind of a black background with a picture of a cross. So since my book is about religion in American politics, Christianity being the dominant religion, the cross makes for a good symbol. And there are bricks, and the cross is kind of there standing out against the bricks, and it makes for a powerful visual image.
Yeah, it's this sort of neon lit yellow and red cross. I hope that people have the chance to go out and get the book and see the cover. In the book, you pursue a provocative thesis in some ways, that culture is in some ways more important than religion in defining some of the key issues in American politics. You start with this clever illustration about the lending of money. I wonder if you would recount that for us briefly.
Sure. So with the lending of money, there are passages of the Bible that explicitly deal with that. And if you just read the passages straight up, most of them seem to either prohibit lending money with interest entirely, or you can only do it to certain populations, either to people who aren't poor or to foreigners. You get a slightly different interpretation through some of the New Testament parables. But when you put it all together, it looks like a pretty clear prohibition on money lending at interest. And that was, in fact, the church's take on money lending at interest for many centuries. But as time goes on and we in the Western world move away from an agricultural society purely, and commercial society starts developing, there's a need for more money lending, and those services emerge. And there's a lot of pressure on the church to change its traditional teachings. And this, in fact, does happen during the middle to late Middle Ages. And by now, it's not even an issue that's up for debate. We just accept that money lending at interest is perfectly moral. We don't give it much thought one way or the other. There are laws on the books against what we call usury, so extractive interest, say through payday lenders. Some states have those laws. But just going to the bank and getting a loan for your car or your house, it's just a normal thing we do. And I use this as an illustration for the broader set of processes that I argue in the book happen over time, which is we often think that religion drives morality. And I argue that it's really more of the reverse, and that the culture comes in, shapes morality, and then religion adjusts and accommodates to that. And with the usury, we see something that looks like it has a pretty clear prohibition in the Bible. Over time, that gets reinterpreted as a product of the growth of a capitalist economic system.
So towards the beginning of the book, you refer to the separating of the public from the private. And this seems like it matters a lot in how different churches evolve and have adjusted some of their doctrines. So what do you mean by this exactly? What does it mean to separate the public from the private?
Well, churches are mostly in the business of religious beliefs and doctrines and building communities and doing outreach and so on. The politics part of their mission is generally not the main part of their mission. But for some churches and denominations and groups, it comes in and is something they spend some time on. So the intersection between what they teach people on a daily basis and then the political implications of those, that's not always up front for them, but sometimes it is. And they have to figure out how do we manage the political dimensions of our teaching. So, for example, if you're going to teach your parishioners, say that the blasphemy is wrong, are you also going to lobby for laws to ban blasphemy? The answer now is no, but in the Puritan era, the answer was definitely yes. That was an offense that could get you executed. And this happens in all kinds of other areas. So take abortion. You could just teach your parishioners abortion is wrong if that is, in fact, consistent with your tradition and your interpretations and so on. You could also both teach your parishioners that it's wrong and push for public policy to reflect that, that is, for restrictive abortion policies or to ban it entirely. And the way this plays out in my book is when there's pressure, when the culture is changing, new values are emerging, new norms surrounding the family or the workplace or the community, and people are viewing the world differently than earlier generations did, there's often pressure on the political stances that particular religious groups have taken to accommodate and adjust to those. And one way you can adjust without directly changing your teachings is to make it a matter of what I call private morality rather than public policy. So you keep the moral teaching, but you no longer press the political implications of it. And a classic illustration of this would be the Catholic Church's approach to contraception in the last half century. So as most people know, the Catholic Church still teaches that using contraception is immoral. Everybody also knows that the vast majority of Catholics ignore that teaching and use it anyway. 99% of all women of reproductive age who are Catholics have used contraception at least once, which is not surprising if you look at, say, the number of married women and the size of their families. So they've come way down. So the Catholic Church has kept the teaching, but the thing that they've changed is they don't make it a political issue anymore. They're not out there lobbying state legislatures in order to try to restrict the availability of contraceptives. And that is a change, because if you go back into the 20th century for about the first two-thirds, the Catholic Church was involved in public policy debates over contraceptives. And the states that passed the tightest laws, the most stringent regulations on contraception, were all the states with the heaviest Catholic populations. So the Mid-Atlantic and New England areas where we had the strongest laws. So that's an example of separating private morality from public policy. The Catholic Church has kept the moral teaching, but it no longer has a political dimension to it, as opposed to some other things that the Catholic Church is involved in, where they have both the moral teaching and the public policy implication. Abortion would be an obvious example of that.
Now, how does this work? What's the mechanism here? Is this primarily about prioritizing? That is, there are certain issues that the church, whatever denomination it is, recognizes are just not priority? Or is it about retaining affiliates, about a fear of loss, losing those that are part of the faith? What's driving this kind of secularization that you describe in the book?
Right. So great question. And I propose two mechanisms for this process in the book. The first is what you were describing there just a moment ago, that there's a need for the leaders to maintain the allegiance of their followers, because those followers, you can't compel them to attend church, to give tithes and dues, and to participate in the life of your religious community. So if you're pushing on those members political messages that they don't want, they can easily leave and go somewhere else or even give up the faith entirely. So there's a need for the leaders to pay attention to what the members want. But then another mechanism is that the leaders themselves, it's not like they exist in some sort of hermetically sealed bubble. They're also part of the larger secular society. So they are shaped by, you know, the media and schools and all the other forces of socialization. And if you play that out over time, you often end up in a situation where the leaders of a religious group at one point, they have a different value orientation. They have different worldview, different approach to how they think about a lot of matters than previous generations of leaders did within that same tradition. So the leaders themselves are often changing just as their members are changing. And so there's not necessarily a tension between what the leaders are pushing and what the members are wanting. When you put those two mechanisms together, over time you see the political stances that the Christian groups in America are taking. They adjust and accommodate to the culture, and they adjust and accommodate in different ways that I try to flesh out in the book. But the point is, there is this secularization that is driving that accommodation process.
Now, as someone who has attended a couple of Quaker meetings, I was particularly drawn to the chapter that you wrote on slavery, though the Quakers fit into a number of different parts of the book, maybe because they're the kind of the outlier in some of these things. But I wonder if you can lay out what your argument is in the chapter on slavery and how churches came to reconcile their changing views towards slavery over time.
Sure. So the slavery issue is a very interesting one because it covers the full spectrum of views. That is, early in American colonial history, slavery was completely accepted. No one was there challenging it. So that's, you know, early part of the 17th century when it starts in Virginia and emerges later in Massachusetts. And then you can look at the situation now where basically no one is publicly advocating for, hey, shouldn't we bring back slavery? Wouldn't that be great? Slavery still happens, but it's in sex trafficking and it's part of the underground economy, not something that anybody publicly advocates for. So it's a full transformation for something being seen as completely moral to a middle point where it was up for debate, and now we're on the backside of that where it is seen as completely immoral. And thus you can see how when slavery was initially established in the American colonies, for the most part it wasn't actively debated. When it was actively debated, for example, amongst the Puritans in Massachusetts, they turned to the Bible to try to figure out, okay, is slavery allowable? If so, under what conditions? And what they discovered was it is allowable so long as you were enslaving captives of war or foreigners who were offered to sail to you. So in other words, the Puritans didn't think that you could go down the street and, you know, knock on Bob's door and enslave Bob. It had to be these specific categories of people. So the captives of war for the Puritans would be in the various wars they fought against Indian tribes. They enslaved a bunch of people through that mechanism. And when slave ships arrived on your shores bringing foreigners, i.e. Africans, for sale, you could buy them and use them as your slaves. So that was the initial standing of slavery. Over the next century and a half, you get big changes in the culture. You get the Enlightenment, more emphasis on reason, some attention to individual rights, and you get the American Revolution. And the American Revolution crystallizes this notion of freedom, which becomes kind of a part of the American psyche. And people start arguing at that point, well, isn't freedom, if we're believing in that, isn't that incompatible with slavery? And in the northern states, the answer to that became, yes, they are incompatible. And so the northern states, as part of the revolutionary struggle, that's when they had emancipation. So within a couple of decades after the Civil War, all of the northern states no longer have permanent slavery. It was a more complicated process in the southern states, in part because it was a much bigger part of the economy and it was harder to eliminate. And so you had this period of from between about 1800 and 1860, where you had very active debates and arguments made on both sides of the issue. Does the Bible support slavery? Because a literal reading would suggest yes. But then the abolitionists came up with contrary arguments to say, no, we've been interpreting the Bible wrong for all these years. If you look at it more closely, let's pay attention, for example, to the principles of the Bible. The principles of the Bible say God is merciful. He favors justice for everybody. There's the golden rule. You put all that together, and that teaches against slavery. Or they tried to go back to say, well, the Bible prohibits what's called man-stealing in the King James Version, essentially kidnapping. if you're prohibiting kidnapping, aren't you indirectly prohibiting slavery? So there were these new interpretations that came along, and those were attractive to people who were living in a cultural environment that was on the backside of the Enlightenment, the backside of the American Revolution, where these ideas of freedom were prominent, and those interpretations just made sense to people who were raised in those environments, even though those interpretations to the Puritans would have seemed absurd. And now we are, 150 years after that, after the Civil War puts the issue to a rest, and the issue is actually still alive in a certain sense. So if you pay attention to the debates between Christian apologists and the new atheists, people like Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, and when they debate prominent Christian leaders like William Lane Craig and so on, often slavery comes up as a topic of debate, and the new atheists will typically say, hey, the Bible's flawed, it supports slavery, why should we trust it on anything? And then the Christian apologists will come back and say, no, you're reading it wrong, and when you interpret it the right way, it actually opposes slavery. Interesting thing about that is, because we live in an environment that views slavery as just so abhorrent, the Christian apologists are more or less forced to take the interpretive moves that the abolitionists pioneered. And interestingly, I show in a later chapter that on the homosexuality issue, a lot of the Christians who have been pushing for more tolerance of homosexuality have used the same kinds of interpretive styles that the abolitionists used, and now they're applying them to homosexuality to say that all these passages that down through the ages were understood to be prohibitions on homosexuality are not actually prohibitions on homosexuality. And so the same process is emerging where cultural trends come in, the secular society is evolving, people are living in a different environment, getting different values and messages from those around them. And then that leads to this accommodation and change in how religious groups approach their political stances.
Mark, the book is just so interesting and so timely in so many ways. We've talked mainly about some of the sort of more historical pieces of this, but I think you also write about some real contemporary issues as well. What's next for you? What is your next project?
My next project is going to be an extension of this one, where I want to this is focused on American history, which is itself a pretty meaty topic, and I do cover from the colonial era to the present. But I want to extend this really back to throughout Western history, and I want to show that the Bible it's often seen as the foundation point of Western society and Western morality. I want to show that it starts out that way, but as time goes on, Christian morality is really a moving target, and that it changes as a result of these cultural trends, and so that the kinds of moral stances that Christians take today are very different from what the early Christians would have taken.
Well, it sounds like our time must be done. I hear an alarm going off, which
yes.
Means we must have reached our endpoint, and it's not without covering a lot of ground. So thank you, Mark, for talking about your book, which is called Secular Faith, How Culture Has Trumped Religion in American American Politics, published by University of Chicago Press this year. Mark, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Heath. I appreciate it.